Today's Teisho will be on case 6 in the Blue Rock collection. Case 6 is entitled Umon's Every Day is a Good Day. Main subject: Umon addressed the assembly and said, "I am not asking you about the days before the 15th of the month, but what about after the 15th? Come and give me a word about those days." And he himself gave the answer for them: "Every day is a good day." Secho's verse: setting aside one, you gained seven. No one can rival you, above, below, or in the four directions. Quietly wading the rapids, you extinguish the sound of the waters. Watching at leisure, you retain the tracks of flying birds. Grass grows rampant, mist lies thick. Fame for emptiness in Zazen, yet flowers rain down on you. For shame, snapping my fingers, I scold you, Shunyata. Don't be confused, or else 30 blows. As some of you know, I was lucky enough this year to be able to go away for a week to Wyoming. During this last March session, I was sitting one morning, and all of a sudden I began to think about my old friend Larry Sullivan. Larry Sullivan was my closest friend when I was in college, and we were almost constant companions. Larry was basically a city boy, suburban boy, from Washington, D.C., the Washington, D.C. area. He grew up in Falls Church. If any of you know Washington, D.C., many of the suburban communities are bedroom communities for federal workers. And Larry's father and my father were both federal workers. Larry's father eventually became one of the founders of AARP. But at that time, which is the American Association of Retired Persons, it's a very powerful organization and lobby that defends the interests of retired Americans. But at that time, Larry's dad worked for the federal government and my father worked for the Department of the Navy. And so we were both living in Northern Virginia and going to school at the University of Virginia. And we were on the same dorm floor because both of our names began with S. I got him interested in hiking, which I had done earlier in my life in the Boy Scout. And I was a terrible Boy Scout, but I really loved hiking. And by the time I was in college, I was already an avid hiker. And during the sesshin in the morning, I suddenly remembered how much I had enjoyed hiking with Larry. And I remembered our first hike, which was, for him, I thought, a real disaster. He bought some new hiking boots, and he hadn't really broken them in. And so all throughout the hike, he was getting blisters, and he was in a lot of pain, and he brought various things to tape up his feet, but his feet were just a mess, and he had very soft feet because he didn't do much athletically, and I think he suffered a great deal because of that during the hike. And he wasn't used to going many days without a shower, and he felt dirty all the time, and he wasn't used to sleeping on the ground. and getting bitten all the time by insects. And he had a very poor pack. It wasn't a really good pack, and it was difficult to carry, and it actually fell apart toward the end of it. It was a cheap pack, and it fell apart toward the end of the hike. And I just thought probably he would never do it again, but he really it really spoke to him. And he became an avid outdoorsman, like it really loves to be outside. I myself love the natural world, and it was very interesting to see Larry gradually become transformed by his hiking experience. He has built his life around being outside, being with nature. He went to the University of Oregon and got a degree in law, and he's a partner in a law firm in a town in eastern Oregon called Vail, Oregon. And he lives in a town called Ontario, Oregon. And he chose this way of life because it gives him a lot of control over his time. And he can go hiking and go out a lot. And he's hiked all over the West and camped all over the West. He will routinely, when he has open time, just go down to Utah or go up to Montana and spend a week or spend 4 days out in the wilderness. And that's how he's chosen to live. It's a really beautiful way of life. During the Sesshin, I thought of our first hike together and what an unpleasant experience it was. And then how much he came to love being out in the natural world. And I had this great longing to see him again. After many years, he went to law school and I was in graduate school, we got together a number of times, including for some hikes, and I was the best man at his wedding. But we hadn't seen each other in many, many years. And during Sesshin, I just thought I would love to see Larry again, and I would love to go hiking with him again. So after the Sesshin, I called him up, and he was very excited about this idea. Basically, we set a date in August, and I bought the tickets, and they weren't I bought them very much in advance, so they weren't too expensive. Last week I flew out after a little bit more than a week ago. I flew out, and he picked me up at the Jackson Hole Airport. And we stayed in a little motel, and then we headed up into the mountains. And it was really a wonderful experience for so many reasons. This is a person I haven't seen in really face-to-face in 20 years. And I think both of us were a little bit nervous about how we would interact, you know, because we had very good memories of each other, very really good memories of the past, but you never know, you know. Time could have changed Larry and could have changed me in ways that made it difficult for us to hit it off. And, I think we were both a little worried about that. At first, I think there was a little bit of hesitation. You know, we both probably had the same thought when we saw each other. Gee, he's gotten old. Larry looks not surprisingly older than he did in college, you know. And I look older than I did in college. And so that was kind of a shock. But we began to interact. We went out for a meal, and we found, fortunately, a very good Thai restaurant in Jackson Hole. And we had a nice meal and we talked about our lives. And we got up the next day and we went hiking. And it was really as though 25 years simply disappeared. And as we spent the week together, that became more and more the case. It was just the pure pleasure of being together again in really what was like a breathtaking setting. I have never hiked in the Tetons before. I've done a lot of hiking in Washington State, in the Olympic Mountains and the Cascades. And I've hiked in Montana. I hiked in Yosemite before. But I had never done the Tetons, and neither had Larry. It was a trail he always wanted to hike. So we did what was called the Teton Crest Trail. And the trail is quite high up. Most of it is well above 10,000 feet. And this is the only time in the year when you can really hike it comfortably, because a month earlier and the passes are filled with snow. You can't get through. And a month later and they're very dry. There's less water. So right now the snow is melting, the passes are open, and you can get plenty. There's plenty of water to drink, and all the mountainsides are covered with flowers. So it's just the perfect time. And Larry, as I say, is this avid outdoorsman. So he does things like this all the time. I myself haven't done this kind of a hike in many, many years. And so I had on a 40-pound pack, which is a pretty heavy pack. I had, basically my hiking boots, my shorts, and my shirts. And we started up the trail, and it was straight up for about 4 hours, 5 hours. But we went through all these beautiful flowers, beautiful lupines and other kind of mountain flowers, just as far as the eye could see. Coming from New Jersey, living in New Jersey for the last 25 years, I have come to appreciate small nature in small doses, where I live, there's a lot of nature, actually, the tree behind my house is maybe 300 years old. It's quite a huge tree. And there are turkeys, wild turkeys in the neighborhood, and flying squirrels and deer. Deer destroyed our garden recently, almost completely. And I love deer. They're very beautiful, even if they eat all the tomatoes and everything. So there's a lot of nature in New Jersey if you look for it. It's very subtle, But out there, it's massive, and it seems to be everywhere. So, when we were driving from the town of Jackson Hole to the trail, you just drive across miles and miles of protected land, and it's absolutely empty. So you can see easily for 20 or 30 miles because it's just so open. There's these giant mountains, and when you look around, the landscape below the mountains is rather flat, and it just unfolds as literally for 30 miles maybe even 50 miles. I don't really know, but it's this massive open space without a single house. It's quite exciting. And the mountains are like the mountains of Switzerland. They're these gigantic, jagged mountains, and they still have snow on some of the peaks. So there's this tremendous openness that's really, really stunning, And as I say, when we got to the trailhead, we just started hiking, and it was four hours up. And then it was another 4 hours up and down to the first trail, first camp. And the camps are very tightly regulated. You're not allowed to camp anywhere you want. You have to register for a particular camping area. There's only like three camps in each area. They issue permits. They're very restrictive about who gets into the backcountry. So on my second day there, we went to get our permit. It's first come, first serve, and the ranger's office opened at 9. So we got there at 7, and we sat there as a line gathered. And at 9 o'clock, we went in and we got our permit to do the Crest Trail. And, you know, basically, it's first come, first serve, and if you don't have your permit, you don't go up there. So we definitely got there very early to make sure we got a permit. And we had packs with 6 days of food and, you know, changes of clothes and things like that. And our food was in bear-proof containers that the rangers gave us. They're like little plastic barrels. And they screw the top screws on, so the bears, even if they get your pack, they won't be able to eat all your food. We didn't run into any grizzly bears, but you have to be careful. And the first couple of days, I must say that I barely made it, you know. My friend Larry is in really super good shape, and sometimes I had to ask him to stop, I had to ask him to wait and get my breath, and he was very, he was a gentleman about it, right? He said, don't worry, I'm happy to rest, you know. And I would get to the camp at night and just be so wiped out, I would just say, I'd like to help you, but I can't move even my fingers right now. By about day three, I began to get my strength back, you know, and really, it was like sesshin. In fact, I was really struck by how much this kind of a hike is like a sesshin. The first couple of days are very strenuous, and I must say, even now after more than 30 years of sitting, you know, the first day of sesshin can be very strenuous. You know, when I go to bed at night after day one of sesshin, I'm really tired a lot of the time. And it was like this with the hike, you know. Day one, I was still thinking about things back here in New Jersey, looking at the trail, sweating, and struggling. And then day two, I was getting really tired, you know. And I didn't care about New Jersey anymore. I just wanted to survive. It was like one foot after the next. And you look up and think, who, you know, these trails, who designed these trails? You know, why does it have to go up the mountain? You know, why not around the mountain? And they really are steep trails. They go up and down. So you go up through the trees. You know, you start out in a valley. Usually there's a lake and there's streams. It's very beautiful, and trees, spruce and pine. And then you go up the trail, and it winds up the side of the mountain through the pass. And the trees become fewer and thinner. And eventually you reach a place where the trees cease, and you're above the tree line. It's so high. And then it's just this long mountaintop, broad, open space with little rocks, you know, like broken pieces of rock as far as the eye can see, and you have to. There's usually there's a trail through there, and so you're going through this glacial area, which in the winter is totally covered with, like, I'm told, 10 feet of snow, and you go through the glacial area, and then you come back down the mountain, entering the trees, and you enter this another nice valley, but. It was not at all cool there. It was quite hot, not as humid as here in New Jersey, but it was definitely in the 80s. And I was just perspiring massively. As with sesshin, it was so interesting. You know, around day three, I began to feel much better. You know, I began to feel like there was this energy in my body, this energy that was helping me. And I began to feel very connected to things around me. You know, without thinking or trying, I just began to have this wonderful sense of being connected to things. It's a beautiful feeling. I realized when I was on this hike how much hiking helped me to appreciate Zen, because the experiences are so similar. You know, when you hike, you know, you start the hike off with a lot of problems and concerns and cares, and it's really like a total workout for your body. You know, you're carrying a heavy load, your legs get tired, and your horizon contracts. You know, normally we're thinking, who knows, 50 years from now, 20 years from now, 20 years back. You know, the mind's going back and forth. We're worried about what's going to happen in a month, in 2 months. We're worried about retirement. We're worried about whatever, you know, the first job and career, etc. You know, but as you're hiking, you know, your horizon becomes smaller and smaller, you know, until it's just like the next step. And this is so much like Sesshin, where your horizon becomes smaller and smaller. It's just the next breath, right? And hiking is for me, it was very strenuous. You know, I'm not used to carrying that much weight. And after a while, it was just like, let me just get up this hill. Let me just get up this part of the hill, you know. And you just take a breath and a step, and a breath and a step, and a breath and a step. And after a couple of days, it's magical. I realized why I got into hiking. And then I realized, you know, this is so similar to meditation. Because the process is almost identical. You know, by around day three, you're just in the moment. And the part of your brain that's worrying or that's full of cares and projecting into the future or reaching back into the past with remorse or regret, that part of the brain is sort of like asleep. And you're just in a kind of luminous present. And it's just wonderful to be there. It's like everything is so alive, and you feel so deeply connected. And that's the payoff, I think, of hiking. It's the reason people do this crazy thing, you know, which in a certain sense makes no sense at all. But I think at the end of a day of hiking, you know, people are purified in body, mind, and heart. You know, the hard physical labor has contracted your horizon to the present moment. And of course, you've been sweating, your heart has been beating. I think I lost 3 pounds a day, actually. When I got home, I had lost 15 pounds. So something was going, I mean, I was metabolizing a lot, you know. But I felt so alive by around day three or day four. I think this is really a wonderful aspect of the human being, you know, that we have this power to connect to the world in this way, you know, through the body. One thing I thought was so encouraging was that there were so many young people on the trail. You know, I had read that attendance at national parks and forests is declining. And I was afraid that the computer generation wasn't going to be so interested in this kind of an experience. But there were lots of young people on the trail, and more young people than older people. And the other interesting thing was how many women are hiking. I was really encouraged by that. It was really remarkable. When I started hiking maybe 30 years ago, it was almost entirely a male sport. You would sometimes see a man and a woman hiking together, but you almost never saw women hiking by themselves. And I saw large numbers of women in groups, large and small, hiking by themselves. And they were doing a great job. I was puffing and huffing up the hill, and they're just laughing and, you know, going right up the side of the mountain. And it was really remarkable. I think maybe it's because many social changes. I also think they designed better equipment. You know, they're actually designing equipment for women now that's very good equipment. I was really impressed by that. I ran into another very interesting person up on the trail. Larry and I were, I think it was around day four, day five. We ran into this guy as we were going up this massive mountain, you know. We ran up into this guy who was actually there with his wife and his eight-month-old baby. Yes, isn't that amazing? And by the way, he was in super shape. I mean, he looked like he could... by the way, you know, when I was hiking, there are people called ultra runners who run up the and yeah, that's true. I mean, a couple ultra runners went by while I'm chugging up the hill. These are people who don't carry a pack, right? They just carry a water bottle, and they run. They start out at the base and they run all the way over the mountain down into the lake, and then they have a little breather, maybe they have a snack. And then they turn around and they go all the way back running, you know. So I thought that was remarkable. There were, you know, people like that on the trail, you know. And this guy and his wife and his baby were going up over this mountain that's like 14,000 feet high or something, you know. And they were all so cheerful and happy. And Larry and I ran into them at the start of the day's hike in this valley where there's this lovely lake. They were both, the man and the woman were both in like excellent physical shape. They both had packs, and the baby was on like a carrier, you know, and it was sheltered from the very hot sun. By a little awning that hung over the carrier. And they were very careful to give it plenty of water. They were hydrating the baby, and it looked totally, the little girl, looked totally happy. We hiked up the mountain, and by the end of the day, the couple came in to the same camp where we were camped, and pitched their tent, and you know, the baby, put the baby to sleep, I talked with him, and you know, basically he was making the outdoors his life. It was a little it was interesting. I mean, actually he was a complex person because he had served two terms of duty in Iraq, and he was in the military. He was in some kind of special forces type thing. So that I had mixed feelings about that because, of course, my father was in the military. I really was sorry that we were involved in the Iraq War. And I thought that, you know, basically a person like this in another time wouldn't necessarily be a soldier, if that makes any sense. I mean, he had grown up in New Hampshire, in rural New Hampshire, and had gotten very interested in hiking. And then his only way of really having a good life was to join the army and serve in Iraq. And I thought that was a little sad that, you know, for young people without a lot of education, maybe that's the only way to have a good life these days. That troubled me. I didn't bring that up with him, you know. I was just very happy that he was enjoying things. And he's a real mountaineer. He does climbing with ropes and hiking. And he said his dream was to finish his 20 years of service. And then he said, I just want to be a mountain bum. And I have to say, I really respected him, you know, for that. I was uneasy about serving in Iraq, about his serving in Iraq, but you know, he really loved being out in the natural world, and he really wanted to build his life around that. And I respect that so highly. You know, When he said, "I want to be a mountain bum," he was making a joke, but he was also admitting something which is important, I think, that, you know, our society has values which are quite far removed from the values of those people who were up on the mountain, I think, you know. That experience of sort of like getting beyond your small self and connecting with something larger than yourself is something all of us Zen people understand intuitively, right? You know, those hikers are having a kind of like sesshin, walking sesshin. And I have lived in both of those worlds, and I can see how similar they are. You know, by around day three, all your small self concerns drop away, and you feel connected to the mountains and the sky, and the beautiful flowers. And everywhere you look, your mind is like a mirror. And when the mind is like a mirror, there's this powerful sense of connection, and it's so liberating, right? It's so profoundly liberating, just like sesshin. And so he was basically saying, I want to dedicate my life to this experience. And of course, this is what my friend had done with his life. You know, he works as an attorney, and I think he's one of these guys who, you know, he works hard at his job, and I think sometimes he's sitting there looking at his legal papers and dreaming of being up in Yosemite, you know. And it gets impatient, and he finally can't stand it anymore, and he takes a few days off, and he gets up there, and he drops the small self and connects with the larger world, you know. And those are not the values of our society, generally speaking. I think as individuals, people can achieve that accidentally. You know, so, you know, scientists sometimes get that feeling, or artists, you know, where when you're deeply present in the moment, you begin to feel connected to everything. I think artists can sometimes have that feeling, or scientists, you know. But people mostly discover that by accident. It's not the thing our culture talks about. So when you turn on the TV in the morning, nobody says, "Well, Jim, did you drop the small self over the weekend?" You know. Yes, Katie, or, you know, whoever is doing the morning show now. Yes, it was great, you know. I dropped a small self and felt my mirror-like consciousness, you know. Oh, that's fantastic. What do you think, Matt? You know, and where's Matt Lauer today? You know, he's dropping the small self. Oh, how wonderful, you know. You know, that sounds funny, right, or almost nuts, but actually there have been societies where that was really the foundation of society, you know, where people understood this very clearly. So like in Tibet, you know, this was the case. And in ancient China at certain times, people readily understood this. It was like common knowledge. I was reading that when Tibet was about to be invaded, the Tibetan parliament didn't want to interrupt the Dalai Lama because he was in the middle of an intensive meditation period. He had gone into a three-year retreat that was very important to his development. And so even though the communists were just about to invade, they decided not to interrupt him. I think that's really... I mean, from a certain standpoint, that sounds almost insane, right? It's like, my God, you're just about to be invaded. But these people understood so keenly how important this is to our lives that they were willing to hold off news of an invasion until the Dalai Lama finished his koan, you could say. Yeah, that's really like a different society. And if you read Chinese history too, there were periods in Chinese history where this was understood to be crucially important to what it means to live, to being a human, you know. That somehow our bodies are like these machines for connecting with the world. You know, my friend said, I don't know what it is. My friend Larry said, I don't know what it is, but when I do this, I just feel so happy. You know, I'm not learning anything, but I'm not sure that's true. You know, I mean, I think that when you hike, you know, you could drive over a mountain and see it. You know, you could have a very high mountain and somebody could create a road and you could drive the car over it, you know. But that's not the same thing as walking up the mountain. I really don't think it's the same. You know, you go step by step. It's like you're getting to know the mountain with your feet and your muscles and your legs and your sweat. And it's a deep relationship, right? It's through a sensual relationship, right? You take a step and another step. You know how high a mountain it is because you feel it in every step. You feel its majesty and its extraordinary size, you know, with each step. And you can feel the air drying up as you get above the tree line, the heat beating down on your head, and there's no defense because there's no trees. So you're in the blazing sun at the top of this mountain, you know. I was crossing over, by the third day I was actually going faster than my friend Larry. I am a little bit, I have to confess, when I was a hiker very avidly, I was kind of a little bit competitive, which is not necessarily a good thing. But I still have a little bit of competitiveness in me. So I like to be, especially I wanted to show that I could go faster than some of these young people, you know. So I really went up the mountain, you know. I was like, get out of my way, I'm on my way. You know, I didn't say that, of course, but I wanted to make a point that I could do it, you know. And so, but I was crossing by myself over this very broken area of stones, and it was so hot up there. I should have brought sunscreen 80, you know. I brought sunscreen 30, and it's incredibly strong. And I actually couldn't find any shade, and I tucked in myself into like a glacier. And it was beautiful. It's like being in an air conditioner. You know, there's this snowy overhang. I got in the shade there, and I just sat there for half an hour until Larry caught up with me, you know. But you know, all of that is knowing the mountain with your whole being. It's knowing the mountain with your whole being. And it's different from just driving up, you know. I was asked to give an introduction to meditation to a group of high school students who come to Rutgers in the summer. And they were mostly of Latin American ancestry. And when I went to talk to them about meditation, the first thing I asked them to do was to take off their shoes. And I said, how many of you at home don't wear shoes? And everybody stuck up their hand. You know, none of them wore shoes, you know. And I said, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, when you walk around barefoot, you get so much more information than when you walk around with your shoes on. You know, so today we walked around barefoot and through the grass. And you know, you can feel the dryness of the grass and its prickliness and the heat. You know, and if the grass were soft and moist, you could feel that, the coolness of the moist grass, you know, and so on and so on. You know, you take in so much information through your bare feet. And when you put shoes on your feet, it's as though a part of your mind is disappearing. You know what I mean? It's like suddenly there's just no inputs. So there's this area of information that's pouring in, and it's richly detailed. You know, there are some people, believe it or not, who never wore shoes in their lives. This is a joke in American culture, but, you know, there was a time when people hardly ever wore shoes, and they didn't like shoes. People used to resent having to wear shoes. And it's not just that shoes make your feet hot and sweaty. It's like putting a bag over your head, you know. You get so much less information. You know, the feet are really very sensitive instruments, you know. They're meant to take in a lot of information. You know, when we put shoes on, we just sort of like close off that part of our minds. And when I said this to these kids, they really identified, you know, because some of them really probably don't wear shoes like in their hometown and things like that, you know, sometimes. And the naturalness of that was very appealing to them. And then I talked about how, you know, meditation is really like using the body to encounter the whole world in a very awake, aware way. You know, there's a kind of knowledge that comes from sitting at a desk and facing a bunch of words on a page, but there's another kind of knowledge that comes from like using the body as a information gathering instrument. And when we do zazen, you're taking in a, every moment has a lot of information that we normally just screen out. And when we begin to do zazen, our minds are so distracted, we're hardly in the moment. You know, when you start to do zazen, your mind is so distracted that we're hardly in the moment at all. It's just very, very tangentially, you know. But when you do maybe a couple days of meditation, your mind begins to be present in the moment much more fully and consistently. And you begin to take in all this information in a more mindful and aware way. And things become almost heartbreakingly beautiful. Just water. You know, one of my jobs on our trip was getting water, and getting water has become more complicated than when I used to hike, because apparently some of the ponds and streams have been infected with various kinds of parasites. So now it's quite common for people to have filtering pumps that you carry, little tiny pumps that you carry, and a plastic receptacle for the water. So my job was to pump water through the filter into this bag, this plastic pouch. And I did that every night. And I would just sit there, and my mind was tired. You know, I had very few thoughts. And my body was tired. But the water, the sound of the water was almost intoxicating. You know, it was so beautiful. And just looking at water, you know, clear water rushing over stones, and then there are these places where it becomes deep and it pools. Water itself, the mind itself is like that water. You know, the mind itself is like water. It can be clouded and muddy, but then it can become clear, and you can see all the way down into the bottom of the stream. And when the mind is in that condition, everything is bright and alive, you know. So gathering water, you know, could have been this tedious thing, or it could have been, you know, sometimes when you're so distracted by thoughts, you do something and then you don't even remember if you did it, right? This morning I was thinking about something, and I started to do the sutras, and I started to recite the introductory sutra for the Taisho. And Jaru tapped me on the shoulder. She stopped me before I got too far, and then I went back to the Atadipa. But I was thinking about some details at home and not being in the moment, you know. That's a very clouded mind, I must confess. You know, but sometimes, you know, if we climb up a mountain or we do zazen, we have a very different relationship to the world. You know, we begin to take in all this information, and by purifying body, heart, and mind, we have this wonderful, wonderful freshness to everything around us. You know, it's possible that you had that experience today when we were walking outside. You know, if you came here early this morning, and you have been sitting since 7. That's like going up a mountain, yeah? That's a lot of purification. And when you walk outside, you know, you just have to be careful to put the next foot down on the grass. And you hear the cicadas, and you feel the heat on you, and you can feel the crispness of the grass. And all this information is coming in, and there's like no filtering. And it's quite beautiful. So you know, I had a wonderful time, and I really enjoyed being in the natural world, you know, in that way. There's something quite special about engaging with the world with your whole body, you know, sweating, struggling up a mountain is the best way, I think, to know the mountain, you know. There's that experience of, like, you know, starting out with a lot of thoughts, trudging up the mountain, being purified by resistance, by gravity, by the heat, by bugs biting you, and so on. And then having this open mind. This is, I think, maybe we're hardwired. You know, it's quite possible that our ancestors were pretty happy, you know, actually. I was reading this article about modern-day people in Mongolia. And, Mongolia was taken over by the Soviet Union during the revolutionary period. And almost all the monks and nuns were murdered by the government. And the Mongolians were modernized. You know, they built a big city called Ulaanbaatar, which means Red Hero. Red Hero. And they were sent to Soviet-style schools, and many of them became, you know, very good scientists and so on and so on. And now they're trying to develop the country's economy. Now they're under the American influence, and they're trying to develop the economy. They're mining maybe minerals, and they're set up a stock exchange, et cetera, et cetera. But a fairly significant number of Mongolians actually have been sitting in their apartment complexes, looking out at the steppes and thinking, I want to go back. And some of them are actually going back, and they're becoming nomadic herders again. You know, these are people like with engineering degrees and things. And I read this article, and somebody interviewed this person who's a nomadic herder, and she had like an engineering degree, and she said, you know, it's just so beautiful out here. You know, we herd the sheep all day, the sky, the lan tien, is blue and clear. And life is very simple and immediate and very rich. You know, and the reporter probably didn't know what to say. You know? But, you know, I'm not saying we should all live in huts, but there's something quite wonderful about that kind of knowledge. Maybe our ancestors weren't dirty savages. You know, maybe they were happy a lot of the time. It's possible. Last night I was reading a book of Chinese poetry, and I was reading some beautiful poems written by people who had lived up in the mountains with great simplicity, and they seemed remarkably happy. We don't have really high mountains in New Jersey, and it's a crowded place. You know, the whole state of Wyoming has 500,000 people in it. New Jersey is much smaller than Wyoming, and it has 8 million people and rising. You know, so we live in a very different place, but we can still have, I think, that kind of an experience. And I think Zazen is really, Zazen is deeper than mountain climbing, really. You know, dropping the self, being in the moment, these things are what we Zen people live to do, yeah? That experience of being connected with everything around you is really what Zen is all about. You know, it's what Buddhism is all about. It's really quite wonderful. Umon, his name is Umon. It means the gate of clouds. And what a lovely Dharma name. Yunmen. Yunmen. Umon is the main character here. Umon addressed the assembly. He's giving a teisho, and he said, I'm not asking you about the days before the 15th of the month. But what about after the 15th? See, he's asking his monks and nuns a question. He says, look, I'm not asking you about the days in August up to the 15th. Forget about those, but tell me about the days after August 15th. See? And all the monks and nuns are thinking, oh my God, what is he talking about? There must be something really important about the days after the 15th. But it's a setup, right? I mean, what Umon is really saying is, look, we divide eternity into months and days and minutes and hours, right? And we pretend that there's something called time. We pretend. We invented something called a year. We invented something. You can say, well, a year is real. It's the time the Earth takes to go around the sun. But who picked that? You know, that's just an arbitrary length. So basically, we invented something called a year. We invented something called a day. We invented something called a minute. And we have a calendar, you know, and it's handy, right? I mean, having a calendar helps us to know when the next session is or when the next Saturday sit is. But you know, people begin to believe this stuff is real. And Yunmen is saying, don't you see there's a fundamental difference between the days before the 15th and the days after? In other words, he's pulling people's leg. And they're all worried about it. They're going, well, what is the difference? See, what's the difference? And Yunmen is, he says, basically, look, there isn't any difference. You know, we've taken eternity and we've divided it up with a calendar, but don't be confused about the fact that really it's always just this moment. That's all we have. It's just this moment. And this moment is like eternal, right? If you're in the proper mind. Are you in the proper mind? And if you're fretting about the future or you're regretting the past, then you're not in the Buddha mind, right? You're in the grasping mind, the deceived mind. But if you're in that, if you've purified body, mind, and heart by doing a lot of zazen or walking up a mountain, then the moment is just, it's all that's left. And it's so beautiful, right? So Umon addressed the assembly and he said, I'm not asking you about the days before the 15th of the month, but what about after the 15th? He said, come and give me a word about those days. Nobody knows what he's talking about. Nobody speaks. So then he says, okay, I'll tell you the answer. Every day is a good day. Every moment is a good moment. Setting aside one, you gain seven. No one can rival you above, below, and in the four directions. Quietly wading the rapids, you extinguish the sound of the waters. Watching at leisure, you retain the tracks of flying birds. Grass grows rampant. Mist lies thick. See, when he says you, he's not talking about your Umon. He's talking about you. Not you in your small mind, but you in your big mind. It's been pretty hot. Maybe you've noticed. My house doesn't really have air conditioning. And it's very hot, you know. But if it becomes very, very hot during session, you know, we might use the air conditioner. I'm willing to think about it. But there's something about heat, you know, if you just stop fighting it, that is quite interesting, you know. To be really hot is okay, you know. Just let yourself be hot. It's not a crime to use the air conditioner. If you have to do something where you have to really think, probably using the air conditioner is a good idea. So please don't be embarrassed by using an air conditioner. When I get to my office and the air conditioner is on, it's like, oh, that's nice, you know. But when I get up in the morning and I sit in the heat, it's actually very interesting too. You know, there's something about the moment, no matter what it is, it's really quite extraordinary if you just sort of be with it. So anyway, setting aside one, you gain seven. No one can rival you. That's your big mind, when you're in your big mind. Above, below, and in the four directions. Quietly wading the rapids, you extinguish the sound of the waters. Watching at leisure, you retain the tracks of flying birds. Grass grows rampant, mist lies thick. Fame for emptiness in Zazen, yet flowers rain down on you for shame. Snapping my fingers, I scold you, shunyata. Don't be confused, or else 30 blows.